Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Kimberly Garza, author of the debut novel, The Last Karankawas. Booklist wrote about the novel, written in lyrical, nearly hypnotic prose that makes the reader feel the Texan humidity. This is a brilliantly plotted, startling, and richly rewarding exploration of the myths that bind people together, generational traumas, and the remarkable adaptability of humans. Kimberly, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, if someone listening hasn't yet heard about your debut novel, The Last Karankawas, how would you describe the novel?
Sure. It's a novel. It told in stories is how I like to think of it. And it is about and kind of centers on this small neighborhood in Galveston Island, Texas, that is called Fish Village. And really at the heart of it are a number of characters, but at their center is a young woman named Carly Castillo, who has lived her whole life on the island, been raised by her grandmother, who is also a native Galvestonian, and has raised Carly to believe that they're descendants of the Karankawa people, who are an indigenous tribe that settled the Texas coast and were believed, popularly taught this way to Carly as well, that they have gone extinct. And so Magdalena, her grandmother, has taught her to believe that they're the last descendants, or they're among the last descendants of the Karankawa people. And for that reason, they're tied to the island. And Carly's kind of grappling with her desire to leave, as a lot of young people want to. To leave the island, to leave everything behind. And at the same time that she's sort of reckoning with her choices, Hurricane Ike is drawing closer to Galveston.
And I'm curious, do you remember the original idea or impetus that led you to write the novel?
I do. As I said, it's a novel told in multiple stories and multiple voices, but I wrote what ended up being the title story of the novel, The Last Karankawas. I wrote it not long after Hurricane Ike hit, so probably 2009. And I was born in Galveston. At the time, I still had family there who had evacuated during the hurricane, and I had gone back to visit them after they'd returned, and they were in the process of getting homes fixed and, you know, property repaired. And so just the sights of Galveston post-hurricane really stuck with me, garbage on the streets and dead trees, you know, like a lot of damage that they were recovering from. And it just sort of stayed with me. So in 2009, when I was in a creative writing workshop for my master's degree, I almost always, as a writer, start with place, a place that really resonates with me or is sitting in my mind that I can begin a story from. And I had Galveston on the brain. So I wrote what would end up being the introduction to Carly and her family and her situation, as they were considering whether or not to evacuate in advance of the hurricane. And then when I sat down to write what I thought would be a collection of stories and ended up shifting more into something more like a novel, they were all in the universe of Carly and Fish Village and Galveston. So, it was always the impetus of what would be a larger story told in many stories, if that makes sense. And that was the first. Yeah.
And so what was your initial writing journey that led you to writing your first stories? And what was your path to publication to getting this debut novel published?
I guess in terms of just my path towards writing, I mean, this is not unoriginal, not an original story, but I always wanted to be a writer. I didn't know any writers growing up. I didn't know how to even begin to do that. So as a college student, and then later when I went back to graduate school, I worked in journalism for a while, and somewhere along the way learned that there were classes and degrees and majors that could be focused on creative writing. And at the time I was like, what? You can do that? and so I kind of leaned in that way. It's not, certainly not the path for everyone, nor should it be, necessary. But that was the one that worked for me, is just I needed so much education on how to find my own voice in writing. And I was fortunate to have teachers and professors who helped me with that. And the more I went back to get more degrees, the more workshops I sat in and deadlines that I had, which were always necessary for me as a writer. You know, I need the deadline. And the way I found my voice in writing, certainly, but also, you know, my passion for teaching. You know, I became I'm a professor now, and I teach creative writing and literature. That's been such a joy to have alongside, you know, my original love, which was writing. As far as the path to publication, this book, the first draft of what would be The Last Garanco served as my dissertation for my doctoral program in North Texas. And so I was really fortunate in that way to have a good sense of the book before I started submitting it, you know, to literary agents, which was my first step, and then ultimately to editors and to publishing houses. So I had a good foundation for what the book, and it did change quite a bit. And there were new stories added and some, you know, that you had to cut and reshift and change quite a bit, but it had the bones there. It had the shape of it and the themes and the people. So I worked on it for a couple of years as part of my school and my program. And then when I finished, let's see, this would have been in 2019, late 2019, I was working on it a little bit more. And then I sent it out to literary agents and was fortunate to land with mine. And he and I worked on it over what would end up being, working from home year, 2020.
Sure.
We were delayed as far as our vision for when we would try to send it to publishers because of obvious reasons. Nobody was reading. Everybody was struggling with what to do with this world and COVID. And so I think by the time we were ready to send and people were hopefully ready to receive it, it was fall of 2020. And I was so fortunate and grateful to land with Henry Holt, who've been nothing but fantastic for this book.
That's great. Well, yeah. In this novel, you're writing about a community and characters that aren't usually featured in novels or media about Texas. I'm curious, was it a challenge for you to kind of find your voice and to write about this community and these characters?
It was a challenge. I think, you know, it's twofold. It's partly internal. I think a lot of writers, me especially, it took a long time for me to find what my voice was, what my writing style tends to, what my habits and my comfort zones are for me as a writer and in my prose. But I think it was also compounded by the fact that I didn't see writers like me. I didn't see stories like me growing up. And I loved to read. I was ravenous, you know, with reading. But the people I read were, you know, like fantasy authors writing invented worlds and characters, or I was reading, you know, Hemingway, or I was reading Faulkner, and I wasn't reading people or seeing myself or people who look like me in literature. So I think at the time, I'm sure I wrote a lot of stories where people were blonde and blue eyed and they lived in New York or whatever. You know, I didn't think that my experiences could translate to the page and that I could write them. Somewhere around age 14, 15, a high school teacher in English assigned us Sandra Cisneros. And that was the first introduction to like, people can write us, you know, we can be in books, we can be in literature. And it was kind of no turning back at that point. I was finding the ways in which I was going to tell these in certain ways and certain styles, but I was also finding out, you know, how I wanted to write, who I wanted to write. And so often it leaned back to the kinds of people that I know very well, the immigrants and the native Texans and the transplants and the migrants and the, you know, mixed race people who surround me and are very much part of my experience as well.
Sure. And I'm curious about your writing process when you're working on a story. Do you usually, when you sit down to write a story, do you have an idea in mind or a plot, or do you literally sit down with an image or just one line? How does that creative process work for you, or does it vary from story to story?
Yeah, it kind of, you know, it usually stays to a pattern, and then I rarely vary unless I'm really motivated to do so. I tend to put off the writing until the very last possible moment. And I'm, you know, I'm just like a confessed, admitted procrastinator. But I just think through a story for a very, very long time as I'm putting off the writing. You know, I'm thinking through constantly the idea of a plot, and plot is not my strong point. I think or at least it comes secondary to the other elements for me: character, setting, situation. And I tend to think through those quite a bit. And I'll, before I start writing, I try to give myself the basic structure of a potential plot outline, if that makes sense. I don't even write it down. I just sort of have an idea in mind, and the basic reason that it's there is because I, as a writer, tend to need some sort of motivation to keep going with plot, if that makes sense. I need to know what I'm going to write next, or else I'll just stall out and, you know, put the computer away and watch Netflix. So I give myself kind of a plot outline, and, you know, when I'm stuck, I can look at it or think about it and say, like, okay, well, the next plot point, you know, she can go, you know, visit her father, and they're going to have that conversation. And so I'll know where to go. But very rarely does a story end up ascribing to that plot outline. It takes turns as I'm writing it. You know, I learn the characters a bit more when they're on the page, and, you know, they make different decisions, or, you know, a certain circumstance will come up that I hadn't anticipated, that I discover along the way. And so that tends to be how stories go for me. And, you know, as I said, I'll refer back to the original plan if and when I feel like I just need some push to keep going. But almost never do I go back and realize that it was perfect the whole time. You know, I'll go back and realize, no, that was a terrible point. I'm going to revise it. Or they, you know, they take shape somewhere else. They become their own people and do things I didn't expect.
So I'm curious, are you working on more stories now?
I'm working on a novel, a second novel that is, at least right now, is much more in the traditional sense of a novel, like this one kind of linear narrative. Me being me, there's a number of characters in it and that I'm really interested in. And so I can't rule out the idea that I might shift over to them at some point and show their stories too. But yeah, I'm working on one novel idea right now, which, you know, as of now, it's about a family originally from the Philippines who've kind of scattered across the world. And it's really focusing on these two daughters who are part of that family who lost their mother, you know, a couple of years prior to the beginning of the novel, and they've lost touch with the family, their family in the Philippines, because of, you know, the link that bound them. Their mother is gone, and the sisters kind of have to reconnect with everyone in the Philippines when they discover that they've inherited this patch of ancestral land, and they all have to gather and decide what to do with it. So they head back and to their mother's homeland and reconnect with her family, and all kinds of relationships and hijinks ensue. So, it's been fun to kind of play around with it. But as I said, I think through it quite a bit. So even when I sit and write and I'm drafting it now, you know, I'll step away and just kind of sit and stare or go for a walk. And, you know, I'm kind of playing with them in my mind. Like, would they do that? What would be the next step? And seeing where they lead me has been pretty cool.
That's fun.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, what writing advice would you offer for those who are working on their own stories or novels?
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. So much good advice. I think, let's see, what I offer. There's a lot of things I could say because I've heard a lot of things, which have always been so helpful to me to hear from other writers. I think I would try to stress that there's no one correct way to write. I think I am certainly guilty of listening to writers talk about having to write every day, and I try to enforce a practice on myself, and that's just not how my brain works. And I'm not saying I'm sitting here going like, oh, the muse. You know, I don't need the muse to kind of strike. I do try to have discipline and sit myself down and write when I can. But I think, you know, someone kind of saying the correct way to write is to, you know, designate this X amount of time, this, you know, Y amount of days, and you know, make sure you have an outline, make sure you've got these things. And, you know, I think every writer needs to figure out where on the spectrum their process can lie and their habits. But also, you know, in addition to that, just related to that, I think making writing a priority where you can has been so helpful for me. You know, maybe I can't write every single day, but I know that I need to prioritize writing if I'm gonna sit down and do it. I need to designate, well, no, you can't do that one thing that you're thinking about, or, you know, clean your entire house, which all of a sudden I need to do instead of write that chapter. You know, it needs its space. It needs dedication, I think. And once I let it be a priority and I make it one, and I make it so, then I sit down and I realize how much it's giving me too, as I'm sitting and writing, like what it's fueling me and rejuvenating me too. So I think just, you know, writers making time for it and accepting that they might have to find their own process. But once you do, I think it's so freeing.
That's great. Well, what books have you read recently that you enjoyed, either novels or nonfiction?
Yeah. Oh, man, I've read so many good ones lately. I've been on a fiction kick. I'm way behind on my nonfiction, which is a shame. I love nonfiction. but I've definitely been kind of in the mindset of fiction lately. I read not long ago, I read Juhae Kim's Beasts of a Little Land. Actually while I was traveling. So that was really cool. It's a novel, it's a debut novel set in Korea and during the war, and examining, like, you know, its impact on a very small cast of characters who are all connected. And it just swept me away. It's just that kind of historical fiction novel. I know very little about the Korean history, so that was beautiful too. And I have never been, so it kind of came alive in the book for me, which is just everything you want from a sweeping kind of novel. And I have tons on my to read list, which has been fun. And the other one I read not long ago, and she's got a couple of books out, so I'm kind of ashamed to say that I just started reading her first one, is Arsenic and Adobo. Oh my goodness, I'm going to get her name wrong because I'm thinking of her heroine. His name is Laila Makabagal, but it's Mia. Oh my goodness, I completely forget her name. Let's see, Arsenic. I have it here. Oh, Mia Manansala, who is a Filipino writer. And it's a cozy mystery, which I don't have much experience with cozies. Mm-hmm. And it was so much fun. And it's from about a Filipino family. So that was a lot of, just personally, I enjoyed reading like all the recipes that I know, and seeing the switching back and forth. She's dealing with her aunties who are, you know, bickering and gossiping, and that's just rings so true. and it was lovely. And so I kind of got into, you know, I had my literary fiction, and then I had like this cozy mystery, and those kind of carried me through the summer when I was traveling a bit and visiting family. So many good things. It's hard to recommend like just one. I don't know how people do this. This is hard.
That's great. Well, where can people find you online if they'd like to learn more about you and your debut novel?
Oh, thanks so much. Well, I have a website. So it's just KimberlyGarza.com. Nice and simple. If you can spell Kimberly with just one E, I feel like I have to often say that. KimberlyGarza.com. And I'm also on social, so my handles are there as well, but Twitter and Instagram. You know, I'm getting better at the socials. I was pretty bad at them. I'm still not great to the, I think to the frustration of like my younger cousins and nieces and nephews, which is like, oh, Kim, come on, like be cool on Instagram. But yeah. So you can start with the website and then try not to judge my social media too hard.
That's great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Kimberly Garza, author of the debut novel, The Last Karankawas. The novel is on sale now, so go buy a copy. And Kimberly, thanks for doing this interview.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
In the parking lot of Sacred Heart Catholic Church, in the cool dusk, which is a lie already because it is never really cool, not even on this January evening, since this is Texas. And more specifically, this is Galveston. We wait. We stand on the concrete, ducking into windows of one another's parked cars to chat, or we sit inside with the AC blasting, or we lean against the walls and watch twilight draw shadows like a dark veil around the church. We are there before even the priest arrives to unlock the doors, or the volunteer choir sets up their amps and microphone stands. We prowl for things to do, tasks to help with. Some of us, like Yoli Sandoval and Tagay Macasantos, cart in vases of flowers from our new Buicks. Some of us, like Gloria Rivera or Marlo Suayan, arrive in hand-me-down Hondas with roses clipped from our backyard bushes. Red. Always red. For the holy day. We arrange flowers on the altar, or at the feet of the Blessed Mother's statue, or beside the portrait of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, for whom this church is named. When we think about that, we place more flowers by the portrait. Some of us, humming with the energy of Santo Niño Feast Day, buzz about distributing paper programs, the programs we have used since we started this event many years ago. The pamphlets are battered, creased from our hands, pocked by ink blots and typos where we list the schedule of the Mass, the Tagalog prayers we will say together, the Tagalog songs we will sing. We place copies in each pew. We sit or kneel on the cushions, our fingers pressed to rosary beads. We tune our guitars and warble a few chords of the opening song. O Santo Ninyong Marikit, Sanggol Nahandog ng Langit. Our voices, in song or in gossip, echo in every corner of the Catholic Church on Broadway and 13th, which had been quiet before we arrived. We do very little quietly, and yet we quiet when Maharlika Castillo walks in. We turn to watch. She has that effect. She strides into Sacred Heart purposefully with her daughter, Carly, is that her name? Yes, by the hand. Hello, we call out to them and ask Maharlika, Kumusta ka na? I'm fine, she replies in pointed English. We flinch. We can't help it. Her English is sharp, intentional, a knife aimed at us. From her new crooked smile that shows teeth to this language she chooses in place of ours, she has built an arsenal. She wages war against us and the world. Once she was kind to us. When she arrived, she found us almost immediately, as every FOB does, bonding first with the ones who worked at the hospital. We walked her through the corridors and buildings of John Seeley and the larger complex, taught her where the supply closets and cafeterias were, where to purchase scrubs, how to update charts, and input medical data for UTMB system-wide. We instructed her on the Spanish phrases she would need to learn. ¿Cómo se escribe su nombre? ¿Tiene seguro médico? In our homes, we passed her platters of sticky rice and whole fish fried crisp. When she wept with homesickness, we rubbed her shoulders, shushing her as we too had once needed. And on this feast day, the one day of the year when the Filipino community emerges from every sweaty corner of Galveston to unite and honor our patron saint, Maharlika was always there. She read at the podium, sang in the choir, served plates of pancit and adobo at the after party. Was it just 2 years ago that she was last here? That she was one of us? Maharlika, We used to say with admiration, marveling at the rare, beautiful name that means in our tongue something akin to nobility, to being of a line with royal blood, Maharlika. But she is exalted now, or thinks she is. That is probably our fault. She washed up on this island with a nursing degree and a job at the hospital, despite having never set foot in America before. We thought she was embracing a new life, as we had. Unlike us, she had family here, her mother, who had immigrated long before. We did not really know her mother, and when she died of cancer not long after Maharlika arrived, we felt no sorrow. But we went dutifully to her funeral mass, prayed the novena for her in Maharlika's apartment in Fish Village. We should have noticed it then, but we didn't. Should have seen the shape Maharlika's grief took, curled up sideways on the couch, cheek to the padded arm, slippered feet tucked beneath her as if she hadn't the energy to take her shoes off.
Thank you for listening to this clip provided to you by Macmillan Audio. To hear more, look for this title wherever audiobooks are sold.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.